and gentlemen, fellow slaves of the plantation, welcome to the Vinny Eastwood Show. It's Vinny with a Y because it's the most important question, and Eastwood, like, go ahead, make my news. It's the lighter side of genocide. Just because we're being exterminated doesn't mean we can't make it fun. Otherwise, what's the point of being killed? The Vinny Eastwood Show. The only thing worse than the truth is Vinny's jokes.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to hour number two of the fastest 2 hours in talk radio. It's the Vinny Eastwood Show on AmericanFreedomRadio.com for your listening pleasure and enjoyment and whatnot. And bear in mind, ladies and gentlemen, this is listener-supported, okay? We're not doing it because we've got advertisers who are guaranteeing us money because we're part of some political kind of shtick. And stick to some kind of wing of a bird that's more akin to a vulture that's picking our corpses clean. We're not like that, okay? It's called not being a dick, all right? As far as I'm concerned, that is the pinnacle of modern journalism. Simply just don't be a dick, bro. And that is the frickin' motto virtually here at American Freedom Radio. That's why we have so many different people with so many diverse views and things like that, that even if they're not true, they're still very interesting to listen to. My very special guest joining us for the second hour is Ralph Ellis. And Danny, you're sticking on, are you?
Well, I'll just I'll go because I'll go to sleep because I've not been asleep and it's 4 o'clock.
It might be an idea worthy of merit.
Yeah, I've got to go on the campaign trail tomorrow, you know, and all that stuff, and yeah, so...
Danny Bamping, signing out, Bampman!
Yeah, so a good friend of mine, Phil, he's done a little song, like a little campaign song. It's quite good, actually, about voting for no party and stuff, and voting for independent candidates, so... Yeah, it's going to be like next 2 or 3 weeks until June the 8th. And then we'll see what happens at the elections and stuff. But Ralph, great to connect with you again, and I'll drop you an email and stuff. And I've added you on Facebook, so accept my invite if you can.
Yeah, sure will. Yeah, great to see you, and we'll be in touch. I'm sure we've got lots of things we can do.
Absolutely. And thanks, Vinny. I really appreciate it, and all you guys at American Freedom Radio. Thanks again. Thanks for having me on.
They do the hard work, not me. All right, so it's for me, it's just a pleasure.
All right, well, don't forget, check out the website noparty.co, and that's the global organization to support the independent candidates.
Yeah, the global organization that is merely a double entendre.
It's just exactly. It's
strictly off the books, bro, like strictly, you know.
Yeah. Exactly. It's great because it's a bigger oxymoron than Microsoft Works.
Yeah. Oh, that's right, good.
I'll see you soon, guys. I'll leave on that note.
Oh, that's
take
that's...
care, guys. Have a good
great
have
one.
A good show.
Yeah. See you, Danny.
Good one, cheers, Mel. Bye.
Cheers, bro. That little zinger there is known as a Bamping punchline.
Yeah.
Now, I believe also, Ralph, for you, we have a big list of subjects to get through, just like we did with Danny in the first hour. So just let me allow to pop that in the Skype chat for you, and we will be capable of sussing that out from the beginning. But in the meantime, tell people a little bit about yourself and what it is you do.
Yeah, Ralph Ellis. Listeners have probably seen me here before. I do a lot of interviews. Got a whole series of books on the Old and New Testament. Finding the entire biblical story in the Old Testament is my thing. So I've been through the whole of the Old Testament, New Testament, finding all of these lost characters, and we'll be talking about some of them, putting them back into the historical record. And surprisingly, they all appear to be there. Mm. Story changes somewhat, you know. The story goes back into Egypt more than being in Israel and all that sort of stuff. But same story, and all the characters are there if you want to find them.
But
it does change the story a little bit, so people are wary of this sometimes.
Trying to find them is like going through thousands upon thousands of years of rubble that is the stories of mankind's history and our literal story, which can get a bit tedious. But your work doesn't do that. It's more like tedium on the edge.
Yeah. It gets a little bit detailed. It has to be detailed in order to prove what I'm asserting.
If you just click on the Skype chat thing, I've pasted all the notes in there for when we're running through the show. And of course, you may have some pictures and things of that nature that you wish to show while we're doing that. And I think we've practiced that technique before as well. So, you know, it's a whole new thing that we're testing here, ladies and gentlemen. I apologize if there's a little bit of producing on air going on, but that's what happens when you're breaking new ground, or in the case of a chili eating competition, which I'm filming on the weekend, breaking new wind. But, Ralph, take her away.
Yeah. So where are we going to start on this one?
I'll start at the beginning of the things that we've got written down there.
Yeah, so we were going to chat about Joe Atwell to start with, weren't we?
Mm.
Yeah, I've written all of these books, and obviously there are various critics out there.
Just remember,
there are
your screen, people won't be able to see your webcam, so only do that specifically when you're actually showing a picture.
Yep, done. Okay, so we have written all of these books, and there's various critics out there. And I find some of their criticisms a little bit tedious now, because they're just, I don't know, they're criticizing for criticism's sake, I think. So the latest one was Joe Atwell, who wrote Jesus Messiah. And we were going to get together with yourself, in fact, and we were going to do a nice little chat about our two books and have a look at the synergies and the differences between
technically,
them.
Technically, we were never going to. It was just like a crazy idea in my head. Have two people who author different stories about the alternate story of Jesus on a show together, just to have a 2-hour powwow or something like that. You know, it would just be fun. But
it was a darn good idea, I thought. I, you know, have a little chat with someone with you know, similar but, you know, slightly different theories. And he wimped out. He refused to come on. And I've had this several times, and I just thought it would be nice to sit and chat about why this happens. And I think you had a good adage about changing someone's opinions, that how difficult it was to change someone's opinions. I forget who was that from. Can you remember that? What was that from?
It was Mark Twain. He said, it's far more difficult to convince people that a lie is true than to convince people that they've been lied to.
Absolutely. And that's the nub of the story. This is part of the problem I've always had with these books. I'm changing the story a little bit for them. And it's very difficult for people to adjust and change their perceptions to agree with the theory that I've set forward, even though there is abundant evidence that what I've said is actually correct. And this applies not only to, dedicated Christians and so on who have problems with changing their views, but it also applies to rationalists like Joe Atwell, who has a very similar theory, which actually is based upon my theory, really, because I wrote my Jesus Last of the Pharaohs back in 1997, I think it was. And he's taken on board some of those ideas. But he's missed out some of the essential items. So Joe Atwell thinks that the entire New Testament is mythology. And it was created by the Romans to pacify the radical Jewish elements, the Nazarene Jews, which I sort of concur with. But of course, in my books, it's not mythology. It's real history. Because, you know, if the Romans were going to make a new story about the Jewish revolt in order to pacify the Nazarene Jews. Well, surely it's easier to actually write a different version of that real story, the real story of the Jewish revolt. And that's what I say happened in my book.
Because there's so many film reviews that I've been watching lately, like the very deep analytical film reviews about what these stories are actually based on. And it turns out the vast majority of the Hollywood films that we've got are actually latched on perfect carbon copies of another film that was previously made, or they're merely reflections of a well-known novel being put forth in a modern context. For example, the Dark Knight Rises, the Batman film, was based upon A Tale of Two Cities.
Yeah, and that's the obvious thing to do, because everybody knows this story. So why invent something new when, you know, the foundations of this story are already there? And in terms of the Romans, of course, everybody knew about the Jewish revolt. So it's very difficult to sort of pretend that it never happened. It's far easier to amend it into the story you want, because then you can change people's ideas of what actually happened. And that is what I think they actually did. So they had this Jewish revolt. They didn't want any further revolts, of course. They wanted to stop these revolutions. And so they took this history of the Jewish revolt and they turned it into a sort of peaceful revolution, a spiritual revolution, instead of a real revolution against Rome. And it just so happens that the leader of the Jewish revolt was a guy called King Jesus Manu. And this is where I think we get the character King Jesus Emmanuel from. So he is the leader of the Jewish revolt. So in order to find the New Testament story, all you have to do is reset the story in the AD 60s. Which is when the Jewish revolt happened. And so my story and Atwill's story is pretty much the same, but he has not seen for some reason that this is a real story. This is the story of the Jewish revolt. And for some reason, he then cannot accept my version of this story and refuses to debate it on radio, and he's refused twice now, because he was asked by one of the other radio shows to do a talk with me, and he refused.
Mm. And he says he will allow you to write him questions, and he will reply to them. But
not exactly a good radio debate, that one, is it?
It's dead air is dead air. Then what can I say?
Yeah, but this has happened so many times. Robert Feather did very much the same sort of thing. Robert Feather is the guy who wrote the Copper Scroll. So there is an unwillingness by many people. Richard Carrier did the same. He's a professor of theology who is supposed to write, and he does videos from the agnostic sort of atheist sort of viewpoint. So he has a sort of similar view in some fashion to my views. And he's refused as well. So this is it's endemic, unfortunately,
and
people.
Maybe that's the reason why you get so many questions about it, and why people find it so strange, because that doesn't make sense to me either, because it's supposed to be like about open conversation and stuff like that. Because personally, I don't like debates. I prefer conversations, because they're actually a lot more productive when both don't actually go into it with a winner-loser mentality. I think through the convents of a decent open discussion, everybody can win.
Yeah, absolutely, because you can feed off each other if you do it properly. I did one with another chap on another radio program, and we were sort of doing this duet going backwards and forwards, and that it was actually very productive.
Talking about the Jewish revolt, a duet, so to speak.
A duet revolt, yeah, one of those, yeah. we were actually giving each other ideas for future projects and so on, and it was actually quite productive. But it doesn't happen very often. There's a There's a lot of people who have carved out various empires, and they don't want to share their empire, I think, with other people sometimes.
Well, sometimes
they don't want to admit.
Especially when you work really hard on something. Well, Mark Twain had another quote about that, actually. He said that a man will not understand something if his salary depends on him not understanding it.
Yeah, which I've said several times about climate scientists. Because one of my little asides recently was I wrote a science paper, a peer review, a proper peer review science paper on paleoclimatology. So I wrote this paper about how the ice ages happen, because, you know, I just found it very strange. You know, we're in the 21st century and science doesn't know why ice ages happen. You've got to think, well, how's that? You know, surely we know everything and nobody knows how ice ages happen. And anyway, I had this idea and I wrote about it. And then this professor called me and he said, well, do you want to turn this into a proper peer review paper? And I said, yeah. So he showed me what to do. We went through this and we actually created this paper, submitted it for review, and it passed. So if anyone wants to find out how ice ages happen, it's called Modulation of Ice Ages by Albedo and Dust and Albedo. So there you go. By Ralph Ellis.
Yeah, which is also used as an aphrodisiac in some countries. Now,
possibly.
One can only hope.
Yes.
Now, so, gone past the 80s, 60s, the other element you were talking about was typology or pesha.
Yeah.
People don't actually understand either of those terms, let alone how they relate to each other in your argument versus Atwill. So maybe you could explain.
Yes, well, Atwill has based his entire book on what he calls typology. So a series of elements within the Old Testament, which are the same as in the New Testament, perhaps, or in his case, a whole series of events within the New Testament that are the same as in real history with Emperor Vespasian and the Jewish revolt. And he calls that typology, which I suppose is correct. But in the Talmud, it's known as Pesha, which is they used it as prophecy. So they took Old Testament events. They compared those events with what was happening in the current world. And they found similarities with Old Testament characters and Old Testament events. And then you could use those Old Testament, what happened in the past, to predict what will happen to the present day events or the present day characters. So you could find a person in the past who was like the Jesus character. And they found someone called Balaam, who is an Old Testament prophet who came out of Persia. And so they can call Jesus Balaam. And you can then, from the history of Balaam, you can predict what will happen, what Jesus will do in the future. But also, and it was very handy for them as well, they could then hide the name of Jesus by calling this guy Balaam. So you could say terrible things about Balaam in the Talmud, and nobody would know you're talking about Jesus. So they used it in two fashions, and so they covered up what they were talking about. And this is a proof, of course, that Atwill is wrong, because the Talmud mentions Jesus on a number of occasions, and it calls him a king. He was connected with royalty and the aristocracy, as it says. Now, the Talmud is not going to be talking about this character if he is entirely fictional. They're not going to make a huge commentary about a fictional character that nobody really knows about. They only talk about him because he was a real character in history connected to Judaism, because he was the king of the Jews. And he was involved in the Jewish revolt, as it says in the Talmud. And this is why they don't like him. Because, according to them, of course, he led the Jewish revolt, which ended up in the destruction of Jerusalem and the destruction of the Temple of Jerusalem. So, quite obviously, they're not going to be best mates with this guy. In fact, they hated him. So that is a proof from the Talmud that the Jesus character is a real character. So now all you have to do is go through history and try and find out, you know, who this character was.
It's an interesting concept of predicting the future by looking at the past. And there's another Mark Twain quote that I think is relevant here. History doesn't repeat itself, but it sure does rhyme.
Yes. Yeah, well, it does. Yeah, it keeps coming back again and again, doesn't it? It's a matter of trying to find that history then in the historical record, which is not easy, but I've done it, and I've done it with the United Monarchy, of course, of David and Solomon as well. Mm. And that brings us on to another topic I think we were going to talk about.
Yeah. And then we have the list there in front of you, so you can run through it at your leisure, because we also have...
can't see that at present, so I'm just guessing.
You just got to click the little...
we go. Yes, if you click the right buttons, you get it. There we go.
Exactly. It's just like on those 60s spacecraft where there's no mouse and there's no keyboard, but there's an individual button for everything every frickin' where, you know?
Yeah, well, it's a bit like Hitchhiker's Guide to a Galaxy, I think, where they had this spacecraft and they had a black console with black buttons on it. So you couldn't see where the buttons were.
And, like, poor lighting. And you're going through space, which is black.
A Hitchhiker's Guide was written, I think, back in the 80s or 70s. I forget when it was. And everyone laughed at this. And, of course, I've got my television sitting over there. And it's a black television with black buttons on it. So you can't see any of the buttons. So, yeah, history repeating itself again. Yeah.
Either that or just designers have a sense of humour still.
Yeah.
This will really fuck with them. You know, you just imagine sitting around there with a huge design board in the background, you know. How do we really mess with people this time? I mean, like, last time we messed with them a little, I wanted to crank it up a little notch, you know.
Yeah, they do, yes.
It'll sell perfectly.
Deliberately, obviously.
Now, we're getting on to King Solomon. Yeah. So let's start with the King Solomon, bro.
Yeah, well, he's another of these guys who went missing from the historical record. So we've got all these characters, you know, in the Bible, like Jesus, and they're all missing from the historical record. So, you know, how could the Jews lose so many of their national heroes and these famous characters? King David, King Solomon, Adam, Eve, Jacob, Joseph, all these people are missing from the historical record, and you've got to wonder how on earth they've lost them all. And it's my contention, because either the whole of the Bible is fictional or they've lost these characters. It's my contention they've lost these characters, and they've lost them deliberately, I think, because they wanted to change the story a little bit. They didn't want to admit that their historical characters were important people. They were
They censored the characters, queens. Just like the mainstream media censors the truth today, you know, and the religion was the media of back in the day. And ba-boom.
Yeah, and it was easier to sell a sob story of oppression than it was to admit that your past heroes were kings and heroes and very influential people, like I say about Jesus. And in this case, well, here actually they do admit that they were kings, you know, King Solomon, King David, and they do say that they were hugely influential, very rich, and very wealthy monarchs of that era. But unfortunately, the historical record says didn't exist. You know, you get people like Finkelstein and Silberman, you know, two of the eminent archaeologists from Israel, and they say that Jerusalem in that time, we're talking 10th century BC here, was no more than a village. So they didn't exist. So they are missing from the historical record. And that's always been a problem for Judaism, because these are the two great heroes of Judaism, King David, King Solomon. And they don't exist in the historical record. So what happened? You've only got, you know, a couple of choices, really. Either it was fictional, or we're looking perhaps in the wrong location for them. And it's my contention that we're looking in the wrong location. They weren't the kings of Zion, which is Jerusalem. They were the kings of Zoan, which happens to be Tanis in the Nile Delta.
And everybody so knows that you don't mess with the Zoan.
Yeah. And that, yes. And Tanis is quite famous as well. It was the site for Raiders of the Lost Ark, I think. That's where they filmed it. Anyway, that aside, that's not how I found David. I found David by looking for his main attributes, which are sort of the Star of David and the City of David. And it just so happens if we go to Tanis, we can find a pharaoh. Well, let's go to Tanis. So let's try this wonderful new technique. So we're going to share a screen here. And
recall that you describe the photos as well for the listening audience as we're going through them.
Yeah, so here is a picture. Now, can you see that now?
I can, yeah.
Good, that is Tanis. So this is the city of Tanis, which is up in the Nile Delta to the north of Cairo, east of Cairo, up almost towards the Mediterranean. And it is one of the most wonderful ancient cities within Egypt. I mean, everybody goes to the south, they go to Thebes, they go to Cairo, and they go to the pyramids, and nobody goes to Tanis, which is a shame because it's a lovely site. And so I spent 3 days here, and I was the only tourist for 3 days. So if you want the site to yourself, you've got it. And it's the site of the 21st dynasty. So we're talking 10th century BC, just the right era for the David and Solomon story. And this is Tanis. And as I was saying, for King David, we're looking for a monarch who is identified with a city and a star. And there was just exactly one pharaoh who was... Oh, this is... it's a very well-made city, this. This is a granite pillar from one of the temples in Tanis. And it's one of the finest pieces of carving you can ever really see, because it's granite. It's very difficult material to actually work with, and it's been it's been really well carved, and carved in ancient times, because these cartouches you can see on the bottom are cartouches of Ramesses II, most of them, and they've been carved into these pillars at a later date. So the pillars are actually very ancient, and they've been appropriated by later pharaohs. And this is the tombs. And so this is the great necropolis of Tanis. And, of course, Tanis is based on sand, so there are no rock faces to go and make a tomb in. So they built a tomb in the sand. And this is the pharaoh I want to talk about. So here we have a sarcophagus, and it's a solid silver sarcophagus. It's one of the wealthiest, richest sarcophagi in the whole of Egypt, easily the equivalent of Tutankhamun.
I bet you if your pharaoh had a sarcophagus like that, he could get into any woman's cartouche.
I'm just wondering how to get back onto you. Ah, here we go.
Click on the Skype and go stop sharing screen.
If we click on the stop sharing, and I'm back with you now. Right. So that was Pasiba Kahainit. And it just so happens that Pasiba Kahainit means Pasiba. my star and my city, basically. It's a bit more complex than that. I can't remember his name at present. My star rises in my city. Anyway, so this particular pharaoh is known for his star and his city. Exactly the same as King David is. And so here we have a direct link between a pharaoh from exactly the same era with the King David. And of course, King David was in Zoan, and this particular pharaoh is in Zion. And so that sort of pushed me towards looking at this particular pharaonic line. And it just so happened that, because what I'm saying here is Pasi-Bekaenit, he's known in the historical record as Susenes. I'm saying that this pharaoh is King David. But if that was true, then all of his dynasty, all of his royal court would have to be the same as the biblical story. And I didn't sort of believe that initially myself. I thought that was going to be impossible. But as I sort of went through it, I discovered that there were numerous links between this particular dynasty and the biblical story of the United Monarchy. So if we look at the daughter of this pharaoh, she was called Makara Mutemhat, which is a complex sort of name. You know, it's a very unusual name in to Western ears, Makara Mutemhat. But if, of course, if we look at the daughter of King David, she was called Makatemar. Makara Mutemhat, Makatemar. It's the same daughter. And then I sort of looked at other parts of the same story. And the famous general of King David was Joab. He was the, because David was a great warrior king, of course, and his general was called Joab. And if we look into the historical record, the general of this particular pharaoh is called Joabnjed. Joab and Joab. Sounds like the same name to me. Mm. And then if we look at the architect of King David, the architect of King David was Hiram Abiff. He is the famous Masonic Hiram. And we're going to talk about masonry a little bit later, perhaps. And so the hero of masonry is not King David or King Solomon. Surprisingly, the great hero of masonry is Hiram Abiff, who was the architect of King Solomon and King David. And if we look at the architect of this particular pharaoh we were talking about, then his architect was called Hiru Matif. Hiram Abiff, Hiru Matif. And so not only do we see that that was an Egyptian name, we can now see what it actually means, because Heru Metif means the, what does it mean? Horus was my father. So it's a standard Egyptian name. You know, every famous Egyptian name or pharaoh was named after a particular god. You know, Ramoses, son of Ra, Thothmoses, son of Thoth. In this case, Horus was my father means son of Horus, effectively. So he was the son of Horus, and
which used to be used as an insult.
Son of Horus.
You know, if your mother was of Horus.
Oh, I see. Son of a Horus, yes. Say your show. Okay, so now we go back into screen mode and we can see what we mean by Son of Horus. So if I click on that, that's the King David character. So that's Susenes or Pasi-Bekaenit. My star rises in my city.
A giant silver sarcophagus shaped like a pharaoh.
Yeah, and the next one is shaped like Horus.
This is the eagle with the Egyptian headdress and that kind of thing.
Yeah, it's a hawk, actually. This is the symbol of Horus. So this is a sarcophagus in the shape of Horus, and this is the next king down. So this is the king Isay, who is King Solomon, who was the next king after Pasebikahainit. And he has a hawk-headed one. And the reason he has a hawk-headed sarcophagus, in my view, is because he stole it from King David's son. So some background information here. King David had a civil war with his son because his son wanted to take over the throne. And so they had a war, and King David killed his son, who was called... can't remember for a minute. Anyway, I'll remember in a minute.
That sounds like the Lucifer story to me.
Yes. No, I don't get that one.
Well, you know, the king and so on and so forth had his son rebel against him.
Yes, indeed. It was a common event, I suppose, in that sort of era, the son rebelling. And so he killed him. So this sarcophagus... Because I think the son of King David was the architect, Hiram Abiff. When I trace their genealogy, I think Hiram Abiff was actually the son of King David. And so this sarcophagus was now free and available, and it was taken by his next son, who was King Solomon. And so I think that this was originally the sarcophagus of the architect Hiram Abiff, the son of Horus, which is why he had a Horus sarcophagus. And this is some of their gold, because this was a very rich tomb. And so here we come on, I suppose, to the King Solomon's mines. You know, where did all this wealth come from? In ancient tradition, actually from the Kebra Nagast, I suppose, the Ethiopian Bible, it says that all his wealth came from King Solomon's mine. So it's not just mythology, it's also in the Kebra Nagast that it came from King Solomon's mines. And
it's very interesting. A lot of these pieces look like kind of like the bowls in particular, they look like golden flowers opening sort of thing.
Yeah, they're very ornate, aren't they? They're very
like the craftsmanship that's in them. You know, like that silver bowl with all these weaves of silver all lashed together, and that kind of thing. Stunning artistry.
It is, yeah. And remember, this only came very quickly because the early workmanship from Tanis was terrible, and then suddenly, within one generation, they were producing this. Why? Because they suddenly got a great infusion of new artisans from southern Egypt. So the 21st dynasty was a new dynasty, and they had a battle. Egypt was divided, so they were having a battle with Thebes, and they started to win that battle. And this is when they started to get this really good craftsmanship. And I think they got a load of, you know, really good workmen, artisans from Thebes. But they also got this gold from Thebes as well. We know that because a lot of these artifacts came from Thebes. A lot of the sarcophagi, the big sarcophagi, the granite ones, came from Thebes. And this is where we get the story of King Solomon's mines from. So there was a civil war, and what was happening is the north was winning this civil war, the United Monarchy. And so they started to extract tribute from the south, from Thebes, and they started giving them gold to prevent them from attacking. And they ran out of gold at one point. And so where are you going to get gold from to continue paying this tribute? Well, in history, it says that this time, at exactly this time, they started stripping the tombs in the Valley of the Kings. So there was a great operation, and they say...
While you're explaining, are you sure you don't want the webcam on? Or?
Ah, yes, I can do that. If I can quickly remember how to do that, we just do that. In history, they say that this... this looting of the tombs in the Valley of the Kings was done by robbers. But it seems quite obvious to me that it was actually state-sponsored. You know, it's very difficult because the Valley of the Kings was guarded, of course. And it's very difficult to just walk in there and start ripping things out of these tombs. I think it was state-sponsored because they'd run out of money. And where are you going to get more money from? Well, the state started pillaging the Valley of the Kings to get more money to stop the North from attacking.
Robbers and thieves. I bet nobody saw that coming.
Yeah, there was a film about that recently, wasn't there? Yeah. Yes. Forgot where I was. So, we're down in Thebes.
Yeah.
And the King Solomon's mines. And so what happened was they were actually in the north, King Solomon, the pharaohs of the north, were receiving this gold from the tombs of the Valley of the Kings. And so they are like mines. If you've been down to Thebes, you'll know that these are great shafts running down into the Valley of the Kings, and they look like mines. Remember, mines in the plural, not in the singular. And so the mines that they were getting this gold from were not mines, you know, in a cliff face taking out gold ore. They were the tombs in the Valley of the Kings. They are King Solomon's mines, and this is where they got all their gold from. And so that became a part of the mythology within Western mythology, but also within the Kebra Nagast, which is the Ethiopian Bible. And so if we go back onto the images, we can now see who this King Solomon guy was, because, okay, we should be back on now. And this is King Solomon. So we were getting here to a height of craftsmanship with these new artisans coming out of Thebes. And this is the death mask of the next pharaoh after the King David character. So
he looks like he's got pierced. It looks like he's got pierced ears almost.
Yes, they all did. Tutankhamun did. Akhenaten did. All of the Hyksos pharaohs of Egypt certainly had pierced ears. And
well,
so
just
did,
for the
course,
listening audience, ladies and gentlemen, we're just looking at a golden face mask that looks very, very nice, actually, with the really cool Egyptian-looking eyebrows and eyes and a motif like that with a little gold headband. But continue there, Ralph.
Yeah, yes, good. Sorry, I forgot that not everybody can see the image. And it's a very Western-looking character as well. This is not an African image. This is not really even an Asiatic type image. This is very much a sort of Western sort of looking face. And this is the death mask, I think, of King Solomon. And if we move on, we then come to another character from this era. Because, of course, in the story of King Solomon, we had the story of... If I stop sharing, there we go, I'm back on again. So we had the story of King Solomon being visited by the Queen of Sheba. And she's a mysterious character because everyone says she came from Ethiopia, or perhaps she came from Saba down in Yemen. But she didn't, not according to the Kebra Nagast again. Again, the Kebra Nagast is the Ethiopian Bible, and it's a very good Bible, actually. It was only discovered in the 19th century, and it's quite an old book. It goes back way beyond the medieval era. And it reads as another copy, a different version of the Old Testament. So it's the Old Testament story, but from a very different perspective, written by someone who had different access to different information. And it has good information. So it clarifies a lot of the odd stories within the Old Testament that don't make sense, like King David marrying a Pharaoh's daughter, which the Egyptians said never happened. You know, Egypt never gave its daughters to other kings, and yet the Old Testament says that King David married Pharaoh's daughter. And it doesn't explain who she was. It deliberately deletes her name. And it's not until we get to the Kebra Nagast that we suddenly start discovering her name. And if we look at that, and the information is complex, but I write it in, explain it fully within my book, Solomon, Pharaoh of Egypt. It turns out that the Queen of Sheba was King David's daughter. So when she was the daughter of King David, she was known as Bathsheba, who is a famous character from the Old Testament. Bathsheba means the daughter of Sheba. And I say that King David was called Sheba. He had two names. He was called Duat and Sheba because they mean the same. They both mean star. So remember, this guy in the Egyptian record was called Pasiba Kahayanit, Seba or Sheba, meaning the star. My star rises in my city. So his name was either King Duat or King Sheba. And his daughter was therefore called Bathsheba, the daughter of Sheba. And that's where we get this famous character called Bathsheba from. But she went off she was a queen of the south because her mother was from Thebes. And later on, she married King David. So in the Bible, Bathsheba.
She was a queen of the south, you know, like, hey, I'd like you to meet my wife and sister. And there's one girl standing there.
Well, it's a bit like that. So here we have the Bathsheba. And so here we're showing an image of a statue with a very prominent queen. And this is a megalithic statue. So this just the head here is 2 meters long, just the head. And so what happened was the Bathsheba married King David. And so when she married King Sheba, she became the Queen of Sheba. So she was the daughter of Sheba. She now became Malka Sheba, which means the Queen of Sheba. So it sounds complex, but it's all explained in the book very, very nicely. So the Queen of Sheba was actually King David's own daughter. This is why they didn't want to actually explain this too much within the Old Testament, because they didn't want you to know that one of the major things of this royal family was incest. And of course, if we look back into Egypt, of course, that's what all of the royal families did.
In fact, you don't need to look that back far on any royal families in order to see.
they do keep it within the family. And here she is again. This is her sarcophagus. This is the sarcophagus of the very lady we were talking about before. This is Makatamar. So here we have a sarcophagus of a grand lady with her big headdress. This is from the Cairo Museum. This is Makatamar. This is the daughter of Pasiba Kahayanit. This is Makatamar from the Old Testament. And here she is again. So now we know who the Queen of Sheba was. So just as a quick recap, and I'll get myself back up here. There we go. Just as a quick recap, Bathsheba was the daughter of Sheba, the daughter of King David. That's what it means. And when she married King David, she became Malka Sheba, the Queen of Sheba. So the Queen of Sheba was King David's daughter. And she was known as the Queen of the South because her mother came from Thebes. She was this was a royal intermarriage, again, standard thing that they do in all royal families, in order to seal a deal with southern Egypt, because we had this civil war between the north and the south. King David married a southern princess, and they had a daughter who was Bathsheba, who became the Queen of Sheba. And this is why, of course, when we come onto the story of King Solomon, there's all this great intrigue about King Solomon having a dalliance with the Queen of Sheba when she came to visit Solomon, because she was his mother.
Sorry. What's a dalliance? Was that like in,
a
his,
dalliance,
in his pants?
An intrigue. Yes, they had a they sort of got together and had a bit of a party together. So this is why, again, the Old Testament doesn't want to tell you who the Queen of Sheba was, although they do allude to this romance between the Queen of Sheba and King Solomon. They didn't want to admit and explain exactly who she was, because she was King Solomon's mother. And that was the reason for the intrigue. And again, it's the same as all of these Egyptian royal families, because Pharaoh Akhenaten did exactly the same. He married two of his daughters. If we go into the first century, Simon Magus did the same. He married his sister. King Agrippa II did the same. He married his sister. Queen Theomusa Urania, who I talk about, she did the same. She married her brother. It was all a part of this royal keeping it in the family, so you keep the bloodline pure business. And
whereas in actuality, it does the exact opposite, and it drives the royal family bloodlines mad generally, deformed and retarded and so on, which indeed explains a lot of the governing systems that were set up by these people, one can only...
Does have a big risk, yeah. If you have a pure, perfect bloodline, it's of no problem at all. You can do it. But the trouble is, it puts all of your eggs in one basket. So if you have a problem within your genetics, within your bloodline, it just accentuates it. And so it spreads throughout your family. And so, yeah, it's not a good idea in the long term. Which we're finding as well in the modern situation with Muslim intermarriage as well. There is a far greater incident of mental instability, of course, within Muslim families. So, yes, this intermarriage is not a good idea. And, it showed with the haemophiliacs within the royal family. Within Europe recently.
The Tsar, in fact, that was dating back to the Tsar of Russia, yeah. They had this
tiny little haemophiliac
boy, and they had this like 7'2" Russian sailor who would like be protecting him all the time.
Yeah, no scratches, nothing, yes. Mm-hmm. Yes, which saw the demise eventually of the entire Russian royal family, but that's another story.
Well, that was also because of getting exterminated, because the people who were taking over Russia at the time realized that if you leave a royal family alone, not only are there royalists who might rally to their cause and threaten your power base, but also they might want revenge and come after you personally. So the tradition goes that if you really want to take control over a country and make sure that the old order ain't coming back, exterminate the old order and all their family and anybody who would want revenge off you, and hey presto!
Then they won't come back. Yeah, in fact, because they were so intermarried, there was a move at some point in the recent past to get our royal family to take over the Russian royal family, because they were so closely related that they are the nearest family to the Russian family.
Mm-hmm. All right, well, Ralph, that's all the time we got. We didn't even get into too much of that King Solomon and Freemasonry stuff, but that'll be for another time.
Indeed, yeah.
All right, you got your website, quickly put that out there, and then we're going to go.
Okay, so yeah, the website is edfu-books.com, and it's got all the information on my books there.
Yeah, remember the kung fu, remember the edfu, all right? It's like education martial arts, bro. All right. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen, for listening to the Vinnie Eastwood Show, the very humble broadcast. And go to thevinnieeastwoodshow.com. Donate through the Kiwi Bank if you're a Kiwi, or the PayPal, or that Patreon monthly, if you please. Very desperate right now. Thank you very much. Show.com. And make sure that when you see these episodes, share them out around social media and all of that kind of stuff. If you hear a great quip or a great joke or something like that, tell it to somebody else. Introduce new thoughts and things and feelings, and open up your wallets. Give us a dollar a month through that Patreon. We'll see you again sometime, folks. Thank you very much.